Hello, I'm Adrian Rodriguez. This is number 0682, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0682. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Oreste Diversa, author of Life Beyond the Pandemic, who talks about the post-pandemic workforce and the idea of quiet quitting.
We're in the middle of I'm not going to say revolution, but I think we're in the process of an evolution where work is being described differently in the newer generations than it was, let's say, in the baby boomers. The baby boomers accepted work as work. You had to go to work, you did what the job required, and you sucked it up. Good, bad, or indifferent, you did what it required of you. And I think the younger generations are looking for more of a balance regarding, yes, working, as well as being happy in their work, and their work making a difference to themselves, and I think the world as a whole.
William Robinson is from Tamworth Distilling. They make green crab flavored whiskey, which is made from the tiny invasive crustacean. Why make a drink flavored with a pesky ecological nightmare that nobody wants?
We have a line of products, House of Tamworth, that incorporate some animal flavorings into them. We have one that uses smoked venison. We have one that uses an entire turkey dinner. Another that uses beaver castoreum glands. We were looking for another wild animal type ingredient. We're only about an hour and 15 minutes from the coast here. And my former career was as an environmental educator, so I was very familiar already with issues of invasive species and initiatives to get people to eat them.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter launches its first annual Fall Preview Edition. Five fiction and five nonfiction books that you should read between now and December. So make some room on your bookshelf or your night table. I reveal my choices later on the Stuff File Program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0682, was Adrian Rodriguez, who is a photographer and poet based in Philadelphia. And by the way, an all-around nice guy. And his photography is really great. As a matter of fact, you can see a link to his photography on the page for this week, which he just mentioned the number to. And yes, everything comes around full circle. Thank you very much, Adrian, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Coming up, we have The Stuff. But before we get to the stuff, I need just a moment, because there's something I have to say. As a Canadian and a member of the Commonwealth, I have many times pledged my allegiance to the Queen. There was a time, back in grade school, where each morning we would start our day standing at attention, hand over our hearts, looking at a picture of our monarch and singing both our national anthem and the British national anthem. Those words were poignant because it was like singing a prayer willing our monarch to have a safe passage through life. That she did. The longest reigning monarch ever in the British Empire. In her 96 years, she has given thousands of speeches, counseling and consoling her subjects throughout the Commonwealth. I myself have taken solace in many of her words, especially her annual Christmas messages. But at this time, as I think back on her amazing life, I'm reminded of words she uttered before she was our sovereign. It was 1947, when, on her 21st birthday, that then Princess Elizabeth Alexandria Mary Windsor made her vow to serve her people for her entire life. And boy, did she follow through.
There is a motto which has been borne by many of my ancestors, a noble motto, I serve. Those words were an inspiration to many bygone heirs to the throne when they made their knightly dedication as they came to manhood. I cannot quite do as they did, but through the inventions of science, I can do what was not possible for any of them. I can make my solemn act of dedication with the whole empire listening. I should like to make that dedication now. It is very simple. I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and to the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong. But I shall not have strength to carry out this resolution alone unless you join in it with me, as I now invite you to do. I know that your support will be unfailingly given. God help me to make good my vow, and God bless all of you who are willing to share in it.
God save the Queen. God save the King.
This is the Stuff File.
And let's get to the stuff. 18-year-old Elizabeth Leon was hired to babysit a 4-year-old in Aventura, Florida, from 1:45 p.m. until midnight on August the 15th, when the child's mother texted Leon at 11:14 p.m. to say she was headed home. Leon texted back that she was heading out because her mother paid for an Uber to take her back home and it arrived ahead of time. Leon told the mother she had locked the door and requested her $168 payment. The mother checked her Ring doorbell recording and saw that Leon had actually left at 9:45 p.m., leaving the child alone for more than 2 hours. On August 22nd, Leon was charged with child neglect and transferred to jail, where she's unlikely to be able to leave early. I also suspect that her babysitting references are just about dried up. Meanwhile, Ryan Boria and Amy Shaner were really hoping for a slow night at the Wendy's where they both worked on August 26th. So as they drove to the restaurant in Tilden Township, Pennsylvania, they made a short stop. Along the train crossing at Industrial Drive, Boria placed a shunt on the track. He got back in the car with Shaner, and they proceeded to Wendy's. Said Officer Frank Cataldi of the Tilden Township Police Department, they told us their intentions were that if the gates could malfunction and they could somehow block traffic, then they would prevent people from getting to Wendy's and they could have a slow night at work. Both were arrested on multiple charges, including causing or risking a catastrophe.
It's way better than fast food. It's Wendy's. Now eat way better, way later.
Not way later, if you can't get across the tracks. You know, these two aren't exactly criminal masterminds. Forming the sentence, "Would you like fries with that?" is probably too big of a reach for their little brains to handle.
Get to Wendy's and try our new hot and crispy fries for yourself.
If you're not too busy. Meanwhile, still with fast food restaurants, a Little Caesars pizza joint in Pensacola, Florida was burgled. Security cameras showed the man checking the door before the business opened and found it unlocked. He was wearing boxer shorts and tube socks and nothing else, though once inside, he found an apron and put that on too. Said the Escambia County Sheriff's Office, it must have been quiet except for the voice in his head repeating, "Pizza, pizza." Yes, that's the chain's slogan.
Pizza, pizza.
The sheriff's office goes on to say that the burglar's poorly planned escapade begins to unravel because the door he came in had locked behind him. He first crawled into the ceiling in an attempt to escape, but fell through the ceiling back to the floor in a tumbled heap of wires, broken ceiling tiles, and hurt feelings. That finally set off the burglar alarm. This fashionista was arrested by responding deputies as he crawled out the drive-through window. 35-year-old Chad Korn was jailed, charged with burglary and theft of two bottles of water, a brownie, and the apron. Interesting door system there. It doesn't lock for the last person out, but it does for the first person in?
Little Caesars, world's easiest way to pizza.
Pizza, pizza.
Yes, but like IKEA, apparently there is no way out. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Gretchen Keola, a member of the city council in Peachtree City, Georgia, was accused of using her position for her own benefit, allegedly ordering city workers to add speed bumps near her home and to remove a public walking path that goes right by it. The path has been there for 42 years. The Keolas moved in just a few years ago, said resident Joanne Boland.
That's why people move here. It's what's on our website. That's why we waited for 2 years to find a house in this subdivision. The pathway system in Peachtree City is what it's all about.
Oh, that's what it's all about? And all this time I thought it was the hokey pokey. Anyway, an online petition called for Keola's resignation, but she refused to say whether she would. That's none of their business, she said. Really? Isn't that exactly her constituents' business? Instead, she sold her house and moved away. The council held a 2-minute special meeting so they could proclaim that Ms. Keola no longer meets the qualifications to hold office in Peachtree City and declared her seat open. Well, I guess that means no more payola for Keola. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? When it comes to the post-pandemic workforce, one of the terms that is trending and we hear often these days is quiet quitting. The trend resonates with millennial and Gen Z employees fighting to rewrite the rules of the workplace from baby boomer and Gen X managers. Depending on whom you ask, quiet quitters are either setting healthy work-life boundaries or doing nothing more than their basic job requirements. Unhappy workers are nothing new, but Oresti Diversa says the pandemic changed everything. Oresti is the author of Life Beyond the Pandemic, a practical new journey handbook, and he joins us via Zoom from New Jersey. Hi, Oresti.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me today, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So where do you land on this issue of quiet quitting? Is it, as you say, or as I said earlier, setting healthy work-life boundaries or doing nothing more than their basic job requirements?
Well, I think we're in the middle of a, I'm not going to say revolution, but I think we're in the process of an evolution where work is being described differently in the newer generations than it was, let's say, in the baby boomers. The baby boomers accepted work as work. You know, you had to go to work, you did what the job required, and you sucked it up, good, bad, or indifferent. You did what it required of you. And I think the younger generations are looking for more of a balance regarding, yes, working as well as doing, being happy in their work and their work making a difference to themselves and I think the world as a whole.
But to be honest, doesn't every generation that comes in, including the baby boomers, don't they change certain things in the way business is done, sometimes radically, just by their numbers in coming into the workforce?
Yeah, well, that's why I called it more of an evolution than as opposed to a revolution. I think that, with, like as you just mentioned, every generation adds their piece to it. So we evolve more to a healthy balance of work and relaxation, a balanced professional life and balanced personal life.
So when it comes to quiet quitting, which everyone's hearing about right now, is there a proper place or a proper way to express that, or can it sometimes go too far?
Well, as anything, you know, it's always about balance, and balance is a tricky thing. Real quickly, I like to discuss the pros and cons of quiet quitting. The pros are, you know, as an employee, you work less. The cons are you earn less. The pro is you learn less. The con is you have less career growth. And finally, the pro is you're just doing your basics, your job basics. And the con is you're getting less promotions. So it has its pros and cons. But at the end of the day, let's face it, where everyone, for the most part, goes to work to have a better life for themselves and their family and friends.
Also, from a company perspective, isn't one of the things that a company has to do to continue? It's like a shark. It's got to keep swimming. It's got to keep growing. And if there's a stagnation, that could lead to death.
Well, exactly. And, you know, and the other side of the equation, it's basically the same coin with different sides. Now let me discuss real quickly the employer side. The pro is that you pay employees less. The con is you get less productivity. The pro is you invest less in employees. The con is you get stunted organizational growth. The pro is you get a docile workforce, and the con is you get poor employee morale. I mean, let's face it, for the most part, organizations, that is, especially companies, are in the business of making profits. Even if it's a nonprofit, their goal is to have productivity and reach for certain goals. So companies are not in the business of staying stagnant. They're in the business of growing.
So from both the employer and employee point of view, how do you maintain a healthy balance in so-called quiet quitting?
Well, that's one of the things I really urge employees to think about. It really should be a form of communication. You really need the communication. Why is the employee choosing to do quiet quitting? And let's define quiet quitting real quickly. The person is not actually quitting. They're just doing the bare bones to keep their job. Now, the question is, why is the employee choosing to do that? Now, is it that the employer is not offering a challenging environment? Is it that the employer is not offering a channel for growth, career-wise, financial-wise, promotion-wise? So the first thing I would always look at is communication and or lack of.
It's interesting because you mentioned somebody working just doing the bare minimum, doing what's required and no more. Back in the day, we used to refer to this as a negotiation tactic called work to rule.
Yeah, I understand that. It's a delicate dance that goes back and forth between the employees, the workforce, and management. This is an old story that probably has not changed since biblical times. Okay. You know, and with the big companies, you have unions and they negotiate with management. At the smaller level, it's this type of behavior where you're just doing the bare minimum to get something. But to me, at the end of the day, it's a partnership. If the employee-employer relationship is not viewed as a partnership, that's when the problems start.
Do you see this as a flash in the pan, or do you see this as a trend that will grow?
Well, I'm really hoping it's a flash in the pan, and the flash was initiated, the catalyst was initiated by the pandemic. I think the pandemic stirred up a lot of things that were there, we just brought them to the surface. You know, I really don't like to see employees having any type of malice towards management. Because that's not going to get anybody anywhere anytime fast, neither the employee workforce or the employers who hire them.
Okay, so if you see it as a flash in the pan, do you, when this flash subsides, do you see any good coming out of this whole situation of quiet quitting?
Well, I'm really hoping to see that work-life balance really improved. We're seeing a movement towards that in England, where they're seriously trying the 4-day work week, and they're really testing it and putting it to rolling it over the fire to see if it's doable. Because at the end of the day, it's really based on productivity. Are you as an employee producing and meeting the company's goals and objectives? And can it be done in a manner that's productive, also financially viable for the company?
It's interesting because we're talking about something that if you go back a couple of generations before mine and yours, people were railing against the 6-day work week.
No, exactly. I mean, that's why I call it more of an evolution versus a revolution. I mean, let's face it, companies are never happy. There's always more work to be done. You know, if you run your own business, you'll know and understand there's always something to do. So obviously what we've learned over the years is that burnout, it does not help anyone. When you burn someone out, everyone loses. The company loses solid talent, good employees and workers, and obviously the employee loses livelihood, quality of life, and really enjoying making a living.
Now, I brought you onto this program because of your knowledge on this topic and the fact that you've also written a book, which is Life Beyond the Pandemic, a practical new journey handbook. So in the brief minutes we have left, can you tell us a little bit about the book and why you felt it important to write it?
Well, I wrote the book in when the pandemic first started because I was very concerned of all the people losing their livelihoods. And I define livelihoods as people losing their jobs and also small business owners losing their livelihoods. Well, one of the other things I do is I'm an interfaith minister, being an all-faiths minister. And I believe we're all here for a reason and a purpose. So I wrote the book to give people a real-life blueprint to really find their life purpose while at the same time being financially prosperous. Because I do believe we're all here for a reason and a purpose. And I do believe that the Creator wants us to be financially prosperous as well as prosperous in other aspects of our life.
So in a way, for lack of a better term, the silver lining in the pandemic is the fact that some people discover that maybe the way they were going along in life wasn't necessarily for them. And because push came to shove, they found new goals and new paths to follow that would be better suited for them?
Yeah, I do believe, I think it was a time to pause, to have society pause as a whole, to say, what am I really doing with my life and why am I really doing it? Now, all work is honorable. It doesn't matter if you work in a factory, as I have been when I was younger, or you're doing life-changing work as a cancer researcher. All work is honorable. But I think, and I really believe, people want to be associated with work that makes a difference to society and the world as a whole.
Fascinating topic indeed. Again, your book is called Life Beyond the Pandemic, A Practical New Journey Handbook. Oresti, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Peter, and have a good day.
Oresti Diversa, author of Life Beyond the Pandemic, A Practical New Journey Handbook. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check the show number for this program, which is show number 0682, and you'll find the link to Oresti's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Heard on many fine stations like CKLU-FM in Sudbury, Tuesdays at 9 a.m.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on the Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll hear all about green crab flavored whiskey. Plus, Stuart Nallman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. So let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? A teenager in the UK who allegedly was hiding from police after a car was stolen hid in a giant stuffed teddy bear. 18-year-old Joshua Dobson was arrested last month near Manchester on charges of motor vehicle theft, driving while disqualified, and leaving a gas station without paying. Police searched for Dobson at a home in Rockdale where they found him hiding. Police said, when we went to arrest him, our officers noticed a large bear breathing in the address before finding Dobson inside. But that wasn't the police's last and final statement. They also made a joke at Dobson's expense, saying after he was sentenced last week to 9 months in prison, hopefully he has a bearable time inside. Oh, how cute. Police doing puns. I bet they slapped the cuffs on his bare hands. Still with the UK, when the Greater Manchester Police pulled over a driver who ran a red light, they suspected he was intoxicated. As police posted online, before being breathalyzed, he shoved a load of coins into his mouth. One myth spread online is that sucking a copper coin can fool a breathalyzer by changing the chemistry of saliva. Didn't work. The post continued, the driver's blood alcohol content was measured at more than double the legal limit. The post ended with, "Don't believe all you read on the internet, guys." Yeah, I'm assuming no one is going to ask that guy to make change. Kind Clinics in Amsterdam, which treats anxiety, phobias, and PTSD, posted a job opening for someone who is able to vomit at will. The person who fills the part-time position will help patients who have a fear of vomiting, replacing a previous employee who retired. A psychologist there who posted the position said the response has been overwhelming. There are many more applications than expected. One hopeful applicant gushed, "Now I can finally share my art, vomit on command." I'm sorry. Have I been living a sheltered life? Are there a lot of people out there who can vomit at will? And is this a talent that you discover by accident or by design? So many questions, so little time. Meanwhile, speaking of time, it's time once again for the Mayor Larry Vaughn Bad Judgment in Leadership Award.
Now, if you fellas are concerned about the beaches, you do whatever you have to make them safe. But those beaches will be open for this weekend.
Town Square in Lakewood, New Jersey has changed. At a time when the world is concerned about climate change, the township cut down all of the shade trees there. According to Mayor Ray Coles, the change was based on a recommendation from the police department's Quality of Life Unit. Said the mayor, homeless people were harassing people, defecating between the cars, and residents were complaining. Meanwhile, homeless advocates called the move unnecessary and say it does nothing to help the homeless. Said Stephen Brigham, a pastor and the head of Lakewood Outreach Ministry, "Well, if they create a shelter, they create some accommodations for homeless people. Then they didn't have to worry about that. It's extremely extreme to cut down the trees. That's not the answer." Meanwhile, Mayor Coles has an answer. "I encourage them to apply for one of the 1,000 Section 8 vouchers that are now available." Applying, though, requires internet access, an email address, and identifying documentation that many of the homeless don't have. Coles says the township expects to revitalize Town Square to make it more inviting for families. Meanwhile, Mayor Coles, by cutting down every single shade tree, you have chosen to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that's why you, sir, have just earned yourself the Mayor Larry Vaughn Bad Judgment in Leadership Award.
Let's be reasonable, huh? This is not the time or the place to perform some kind of a half-assed autopsy on a fish.
Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? They say that necessity is the mother of invention. Well, there is an invasive marine species, the green crab, that is wreaking ecological and economic havoc along the New England coast. So what to do with these creatures? Well, Tamworth Distilling has decided to catch the little buggers and create House of Tamworth Crab Trapper Green Crab Flavored Whiskey. William Robinson is a product development associate with Tamworth Distilling, and he joins us via Zoom from New Hampshire. Hi, William.
Hello there.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, happy to be here.
So at what point did you, your company, decide these little creatures, something has to be done about it, and we're the ones to do it?
Well, I actually came on with them about a year ago, and I was very familiar. I've been friends with the head distiller and the head chemist for years, since they opened, really, almost a decade ago. I had done some flavor work with them in the past, and we have a line of products, House of Tamworth, that incorporate some animal flavorings into them. We have one that uses smoked venison. We have one that uses an entire turkey dinner, another that uses beaver castoreum glands. So we were looking for another wild animal type ingredient. ingredient, and we're only about an hour and 15 minutes from the coast here. And my former career was as an environmental educator, so I was very, very familiar already with issues of invasive species and initiatives to get people to eat them. For instance, the lionfish down in the Key, the Asian carp in the Midwest. And I knew that there was a program with UNH that was doing something similar. And so it kind of seemed like a kind of a perfect storm of a story. I grew up in the Deep South. I cooked for a living for a long time. I was very familiar with cooking with seafood. And I knew that you could take something that might be considered off-putting and given the right kind of spices, it gives it kind of a depth and complexity that it wouldn't have otherwise. We decided to go for it.
Let's talk about these creatures to begin with, the green crab. It's an invasive marine species in your neck of the woods. Has it always been an invasive marine species, or is it something that has cropped up in the last, I don't know, half a century or whatever?
Well, it's been here for over 200 years. They're native to Europe, and they hitchhiked over ballast sailing ships. As long as we had ships moving back and forth. The issue is that here on our coast, the estuaries used to freeze. So, and in freezing, they would kill a large number of these crabs every year. And so now with global warming, we've kind of reached a point where we've had a number of years where the estuaries haven't frozen and their numbers are starting to really, really boom and adversely impact some of our other fisheries in New England.
Why are they considered invasive? What do they do that makes them that way?
Well, they didn't evolve in the ecosystem here in New England on the coast. They evolved in a different ecosystem, one in Europe. When that happens with animals or plants, they're not natural kind of checks and balances built into the ecosystem. Whereas where they're indigenous, they would have natural predators or diseases or weather that would kind of help keep their numbers back. And that's not so much the case here.
So they have no predators at all?
I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot of animals that feed on them. One of the major uses of them is is as bait. A lot of the crabs spoken with, people that catch them specifically, they're actually shipping them out to use as bait on other parts of the East Coast. So no, they do have, things are definitely eating them. They're really doing well in the habitat here in Northern New England, particularly since the estuaries aren't freezing anymore. They're each capable of eating upwards of 40 small shellfish, whether that's scallops or oysters, every single day. So, there are all kinds of fisheries are feeling the impact. Lobstermen constantly finding more traps. So it's an issue all over the place.
You say people are using them as bait. So it's are these something that themselves, before you get to the distilling process itself, is this something that in itself is not edible?
They're a delicacy in Venice, actually, and they farm them there. But we don't have as much information about consuming them here. So we decided to work with UNH. They were able to, they had contacts, with people with the FDA and whatnot to talk us through, making sure that this was all a viable food source. But that's part of their initiative, is actually working with local restaurants and fishermen, trying to create a market for these crabs, for people to eat them. Their focus of study right now is predicting the molting patterns of these crabs so that they can create possibly a soft shell market for them, much in the way that there's a soft shell market for the blue crab.
So they're evasive. They're causing a problem within the community, within the ecosystem. How will your work with the distilling of these change that or help that situation?
It's the story. I use about 1,000 of them, about 100 pounds per batch. This year, we were limited to 4 batches. That's all we made. I'm under no illusion that my numbers of use of the crab is going to do anything to really even put a dent in their population. However, the way this story has kind of caught on and gone viral, the awareness that it brings to the situation and the awareness that it brings to people, that where you can see firsthand how global warming is negatively impacting our neighbors and fishermen that work on the coast, it's a direct impact from that. And it's kind of hard to argue against it.
We go from the idea of using these things to distilling them and putting them in alcohol.
Yes.
And in a whiskey. So what's that process like? And how do you know you've got the right recipe, combination, whatever?
That's one of the interesting things about the distilling world. Everything we do is science-based. However, there's so many variables, and it ends up becoming based on taste, which is subjective, not really an objective measurement. It is kind of alchemy working with it. In our case, We are kind of an unusual distillery in that we use vacuum stills for our for kind of flavor extraction. Our head chemist and myself, we make hundreds of different types of botanical infusions, you know, using our neutral spirit, which is like the base spirit that you'd use for a gin or for a vodka that we produce. So we make these infusions with different types of botanicals, and then we distill those on what's called a rotary evaporator. It's used mostly in the chemical industry or pharmaceutical industry as a way to remove solvents from some particular base that you're working with. In our case, we use ethanol as a solvent to liberate some of the aroma and flavor molecules that are in botanicals, or in the case of the crab, a crab base. And then that carries it over, and we're able to use those as a flavorant. So there's not a whole lot of distilleries in the country using this technology right now. We've been using it a number of years, but it's still kind of a new thing for distilleries to use. So with the crabs, what I did essentially was I began trying to figure out what kind of flavoring I would end up with. I cleaned them, processed them, and cooked them much in the same way that you would if you were going to prepare them to eat. They're a little small, so that's the issue with cleaning them for meat. It's kind of like a friend put it to me, like it's kind of like eating sunflower seeds. You know, a lot of work for just a little bit of meat. So anyway, we use them to make a stock. I bring them to a slow simmer until they're thoroughly cooked, and then I remove the solids from the stock and allow that to cool, and then I fortify it with some of our ethanol, and then that's distilled. In turn, I take that distillate and I recombine it with some more crab base, and then distill it a second time in order to kind of crush more of that flavor into the distillate. I wasn't sure originally which direction I was going to go. I'm very, very, very interested in Asian cooking, in particular Japanese cooking. So I thought, you know, there's a couple different directions we could go that way. But being that I'm from the deep south of the U.S., southeastern U.S., I decided to go with my roots and do it more like a crab boil or a seafood boil. So we have this 300-year history of seafood spice blends on the east coast of the U.S. that that were used traditionally. I mean, we didn't have refrigeration. Seafood was a little bit sharper in the past than we're used to it these days. So they came up with these spice blends to kind of balance out the sharpness, the harshness that seafood can have when we cook it. And I came up with a blend of about 8 different spices that work well with the bourbon base that I had. The bourbon had a lot of caramel, vanilla, kind of maple notes to it. And I used the spices were mustard seed, dill seed, paprika, fresh bay leaf, allspice, clove, and cinnamon. Those essentially were put into a slurry made into the kind of a tea, fortified with some of our ethanol, and then distilled to create kind of a distillate of that. And then the spice distillate, the crab distillate are then blended in with the bourbon to make our finished product.
Whoa, it sounds like you're giving away your secrets here. I don't want to take too much information from you.
It's okay, because not a lot of people have access to this type of machinery. The vacuum still, like I'm talking about. So, and the measurements and whatnot, you know, you'd have to figure out on your own. But
for someone who is a whiskey drinker, how would you describe the taste, and how is it different from other whiskeys that are out there?
Well, it's definitely a flavored whiskey. The spice stands out. So you notice the spice off the bat, the coriander and the bay, followed by the clove and cinnamon and allspice. You get that smell of those when you smell it. And the crab can be kind of hard sometimes for people to notice. It's really amazing how the spices kind of wrap around it. But once you take a sip and you swallow or allow it to coat your tongue, and you take another sniff of it or another taste of it, you'll definitely notice the crab. The crab is kind of a buttery sort of thing that sits right in the middle of the palate. And it's followed up. You get a lot of the clove and cinnamon towards the end, along with a little bit of heat from those as well. So some people have compared it to a briny fireball. I'm not a big fan of that description, but it does have some spice to it.
How is it selling? And when did you first produce this? And how is it selling so far?
We released it Memorial Day weekend with the plan of just making one batch. And we are currently working through batch number four, but we don't have any more bourbon base to make anymore this year. So, because the barrels have to age out before we can use them. Yeah, it's done really well. Definitely been a big seller for us this summer.
Are you selling it beyond your neighborhood, beyond the United States, worldwide?
Fortunately, we don't have any sort of distribution. It gets very, it's difficult just to sell liquor across state lines here in the U.S. We have a mail order company called Sealbox that carries it online for several states in the U.S. But we can't even ship it to all 50 states. So, liquor laws.
Well, as the saying goes on your own PR, if you can't beat them, drink them.
That's right. The crabs, the crabs you want, not the crabs you deserve.
Exactly. William, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
All right. Thank you, Anthony.
William Robinson, Product Development Associate with Tamworth Distilling, makers of House of Tamworth Crab Trapper Green Crab Flavored Whiskey. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0682, and you'll find the link to their site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a show that is heard on many a fine radio station like World FM 88.2 FM in New Zealand, Wednesdays at 4 p.m.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Hey, how would you like to become a patron of the Stuff File program? It's easy to do. By going to patreon.com and becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. If you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. Join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Melman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And as the kiddies are all back in school, Stuart Nullman is here with some reading material on the heavier side for the fall season. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And when we talked about this special edition of Book Banter, I had one thing in mind, and that was TV Guide.
Oh, yeah, the fall preview.
Yeah, because that was, for us, couch potatoes. You know, a long time ago, the TV Guide Fall Preview Show was a much anticipated magazine to get once it was available, so we could see what's going to be, invading the three networks for the fall season.
Not only was it a must get, it was a must keep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
So what are some of the must reads for the fall?
Well, I figured on this edition of Book Banter, it'll be the first annual fall preview edition, and I have five nonfiction and five fiction books that you can consider reading between now and the end of the year.
Did you just say 10 books?
Well, I'm going to go through them very quickly.
Okay, stopwatch is going.
All right, so I'm going to start with nonfiction very quickly. If you were a fan of the Degrassi series,
right?
That was one of my guilty pleasures. Well, the creator, Linda Skyler, is coming out with her memoir and behind the scenes look at this TV show that forever changed young adult television. It's called The Mother of All Degrassi, and that's coming out in November, Peter. Ben, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Canada-Russia Hockey Series, and there's two books coming out. One that's just got released, and it's by Terry Mosher, known as Aislinn, the award-winning cartoonist, called Montreal to Moscow, because he was there throughout the whole series, and it's a selection of his best cartoons that he drew during that period, that 27 days in September.
Wow.
And Ken Dryden, who was the goalie for Team Canada, one of the goalies for Team Canada, he's putting out his own book on his take of the Canada-Russia series called plainly The Series. And he's quite a writer, so I'm looking forward to seeing his point of view about that epic Canada-Russia series.
Okay, three down, seven to go.
Okay, but Bob Dylan, who you think he would follow up his best-selling autobiography Chronicle with Volume 2, but no. He does his take on music with the philosophy of modern song, okay? Then Jerry Seinfeld is doing his third book, but it's not his best of humor. It's basically a companion book to his streaming series, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. So I guess you get the whole story behind, you know, the episodes and what kind of coffee these comedians like to drink. And if you're a fan of presidential biographies, John Meacham, who you always see on CNN or CNBC, he's written several best-selling biographies about Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson and George H.W. Bush. But now he takes his turn with the most written about president next to Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy. This is Abraham Lincoln, and the book is called And There Was Light. So that's coming up in October. So if you love presidential bios, this is a must-read.
John Meacham is amazing. I'll just leave it at that.
Yes, I agree. No argument there, Peter.
Yep.
Now let's go on to fiction. If you're a Stephen King fan, he is back, but this time he's delving for the second time into the world of fantasy novels. His first with Eyes of the Dragon, which was great. It's called Fairy Tale, and this was deemed as a passion project which King wrote during the pandemic. Then, if you like Leonard Cohen, I found out from McClellan and Stewart that they are posthumously publishing a book called A Ballet of Lepers, which is basically a novella and a collection of short stories that have never been published before that were written by the great Leonard Cohen. Then there's one book that's been on every upcoming fall must-read list, and it's called The Cloisters by Katie Hayes. It deals with the mystery behind a 15th century set of tarot cards.
Hmm.
So, and everyone's raving about that one, and it's a thing, it's a must read, so I'll give that a shot. Also, John Irving, he releases his first novel in almost 8 years, and it's called The Last Chairlift. I wonder how to do with skiing.
The Last Chairlift.
The Last Chairlift. Well, then again, Cider House Rules.
It could be the ceremony at a Jewish wedding.
Oh, that's true. That's
true. With a very heavy bride and groom.
Yeah, which could be the last chairlift for some people involved.
Exactly.
And finally, there's this name of this novelist. Her name is Colleen Hoover, and she's proven to be, over the past couple of years, a very popular author. In fact, I checked the most recent New York Times bestseller list in the trade paperback fiction category. And out of the 15 books that are listed there, seven of them are written by Colleen Hoover. So that piqued my curiosity. And she has a new book coming out this fall. It's called It Starts With Us, which is a sequel of one of her best-selling novels called It Ends With Us. It's sort of like a sequel in reverse, I guess.
Hmm. It's interesting. You said you were going to sneak in 10 10 titles. You actually got 11.
Well, yeah, when you count about the Canada-Russia books, yeah, you're right.
You got 11.
That was I did pretty good, did I?
Nothing gets past me. Nothing gets past me. Now, I'm just curious to know, out of all those titles you mentioned, not 10, but 11, which one are you most excited about?
The one I really is the two books about the Canada-Russia series. I mean, these are from two unique perspectives. A newspaper cartoonist and a hero to many Montreal Canadiens fans who was there on the ice, you know, facing those Russian slap shots and shots on goal. So I think that's going to be pretty interesting. And that was one of our biggest moments in Canadian history next to the end of World War II.
I'm guessing that those two books, maybe either individually or together, would be a great Christmas gift for any hockey fan.
Oh, certainly will. And if you add that Scott Morrison's book called 1972, which was released back in the spring, then you got yourself a nice little trifecta there. Hmm.
Have you already put in your dibs to all of the publishers to get every single one of these books?
Most of them, especially the nonfiction ones, but I'm going to have to work on the fiction, because I've already requested the Leonard Cohen, the Stephen King, and the Colleen Hoover one. I want to see how the last chairlift, how that one weighs in.
We need to have that one reviewed on Bookbander in the future, if only to make sure that it is or is not about a Jewish wedding.
Or it could be about skiing.
About skiing. We could go either way.
Yes, certainly would.
Or it could be about a family of movers.
That too. I think the possibilities are endless. You don't know with John Irving. I mean, he's written great books. I love, my favorite is still The Hotel in New Hampshire, and World According to Garp.
Absolutely.
But we'll see what that original crazy mind is up to.
In any case, how can we get in contact with you other than waiting at the post office for your books to arrive?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to be in a car getting coffee, because I'll probably spill it all over the car. But you can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every week, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu, and happy fall reading.
Well, I certainly will, and happy fall to you, too.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. And, of course, an idiot of the day. Since late January, at least 8 Russian oligarchs have died from suicide or unexplained accidents. All of the men were connected with large Russian energy companies. Most recently, Lukoil chairman Ravil Maganov, who criticized his country's invasion of Ukraine, fell from a hospital window in Moscow. In some cases, executives' wives and children were also killed. The deaths are not just within Russia. Russian oil and gas billionaire Mikhail Watford was found dead in his home in England. Another was killed along with his wife and daughter at a resort in Spain. Vasily Melnikov died at his home in Russia along with his wife and 4 and 10-year-old children. Investigators are calling that one a murder-suicide because there were no signs of an authorized entry, even though all of them were stabbed to death. In addition, dozens of reporters who have criticized the war in Ukraine have died in suicides and accidents, many by falling out of windows. What this story is teaching me is that working in the fossil fuel industry in Russia can be deadly. Also, it's best to live on the ground floor and have nothing sharper than a butter knife in your home. Police arrested a meatpacker employee on Long Island for tampering with the product about to go out to consumers. 38-year-old Karen Palacios Gutierrez was arrested on August 25th in Hicksville. According to detectives, while working as a meatpacker for the Ava companies, Palacios Gutierrez allegedly removed a coin from her pocket and placed it into a meat package that was set to go out for retail consumption. The bin of meat products that were set to be distributed for retail consumption were discarded, causing a loss of $400. Police responded to the Ava Food Packing Company and placed Palacios Gutierrez under arrest. She is charged with criminal mischief, tampering with consumer product, and criminal nuisance. I wonder why she did it. Karen, here's a penny for your thoughts. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
The terrifying video shows a woman blindfolded, blood dripping from her mouth. Standing behind her, a man holds a knife to his captive's throat. "Mommy, they've kidnapped me. Mommy, I don't know why," sobs the young woman in the frame. "You can't say anything to the police. If you do, they'll kill me." But the supposed victim's life was never really in danger. In fact, she faked the whole thing. The 30-year-old woman and four others were arrested on the Spanish island of Tenerife over an alleged plot to extort a $50,000 ransom payment out of the arrested woman's mother. When her worried mother received the blood-curdling clip, she duly withdrew cash to pay the ransom. Incredibly, investigators would later discover that the mother had already made similar payments totaling $45,000 on three previous occasions when she'd received menacing letters threatening the life of her daughter. When authorities arrested the group over the alleged scheme, the woman in the clip and her accused co-conspirators were living it up at a slot machine casino. They now face charges including extortion and other offenses, with an extortion charge alone carrying a sentence between 1 and 5 years imprisonment in Spain. Now, for the first time, I'm going to give you a choice for this week's award. You can choose the side you fall on. Why? Oh, why? Would you think that you could extort money with a fake kidnapping threat not once, not twice, not three times, but four times and get away with it? On the other hand, how can you fall for a fake kidnapping plot four times? One reason, and one reason only, you're all idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0682. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0682. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including KDXRadio.com, TrueTalkRadio.com, over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, Free 99 in Tyler, Texas, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, CHSR in Fredericton, and also streaming on just about any streaming service your heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this burning question. How come birds aren't tickled by feathers?